This is Age of Treason Radio. On the White Network.
And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's gone. You better learn your past, you better learn young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
Well, good evening, everyone. The title of tonight's installment is White Identity, Suppressed and Repressed. So far in this series of podcasts, I've talked, especially recently, about a negative white identity, and I've tried to describe it in fair terms without exaggerating, how whiteness is defined through guilt-tripping, the litany of white sins, stupid, crazy, evil, the most recent installment, anti-white identity, where I described how what's called identity politics is where identity is based on victimhood and everyone's a victim of whites who are oppressing them. And that's white's role in identity politics as the bad guy. To borrow a turn of phrase from the Jews, it's as if they're blaming all the world's problems on whites. And as we saw in the last installment, if you can blame whites for flesh-colored band-aids, then you can blame us for just about anything. But I want to move away from the purely negative and start to talk more about the positive aspects of white identity and whites as a group. We're not going to leave behind the negativity entirely. It's going to be a transition. What I'm going to do here is cite a couple of anti-whites. And the interesting thing about these people and their points of view is that they seem more free in their talking about whiteness than most white people do. When I discuss with people, friends or recent people I bump into in the real world that aren't white racialists, don't identify themselves as white, they usually get very uncomfortable if I start using the word white in a conversation, just in non-negative terms and in positive terms. They get especially nervous and start looking around and to see if anyone hears. And this is why, as you know, the negative identity that is what exists today is what's in their head, and they are afraid to think of themselves as white. They really don't want to think of themselves as white. They don't want to think about whiteness. But these anti-whites, these people are very free in how they describe and talk about whiteness when they're against whiteness, when they're opposed to it. So let me cite one quickly here. It's in response to a review of or a critique of Pat Buchanan's book that came out, and this article was published back in October of last year, so almost a year ago. And Pat Buchanan wrote or published a book at the time called Suicide of a Superpower, Will America Survive to 2025? The title of the article was decrying, quote, slow death of white America. Pat Buchanan warns that minorities lower test scores. And the article itself talks about a bunch of other hate facts that Pat Buchanan, or hate opinions, you could call them, that Pat Buchanan had. But what was interesting to me was one of the commenters down below, her name was Shannon Corwin. Now, this is a nobody, and I acknowledge that. This is not some captain of industry or leading politician saying this. This is just an ordinary person. This is somebody, as far as I know, they might be a college professor for all I know. They're a top commenter here on this site, Think Progress. But that's about the only credentials or claim to fame that they have, as far as I know. But the point is that this is, I think, the ideas that are being fed from the top down, the negative ideas about whiteness, they filter down to people like Shannon Corwin, who then put their own spin on it or put it in their own words, and that's why it's precious for that reason. So she writes, "Whiteness as a culture and identity is a myth. It was brought about during the early days of the colonies, when rich white males saw that workers were finding common struggles with minorities. They aimed to drive a wedge in order to control the population. They fed the European settlers a lie, telling them that they could have some land and a voice if they helped keep the POC population," I guess that's people of color, "in check. Before all this, European nations that were predominantly white did not bond over their quote unquote whiteness. They fought each other as Frenchmen, British, Spaniards, etc. I welcome the decline." This is where it gets good. "I welcome the decline of white as an identity. Be proud of your heritage. Be proud of being French, German, Irish, or whatever. But understand, there is no pride in simply being, quote, white. The things that Buchanan are saying only serve to divide the people, not unite them. Down with the white supremacist culture of America." A couple of things to say in response to this is, for some reason, she considers white to be a myth, but people of color isn't a myth. People of color are real. And she also talks about these rich white males as if they're real, as if their whiteness is real. So I don't think she's thought this quite through, this circular logic that she has, that, you know, white people made up the myth of whiteness. It is, I'll point out, the Marxist idea of identity, though, and being a divide and conquer tactic that the rich white people are using to divide everybody else. But it's interesting that she, I guess, slipped there and said rich white and didn't just say rich males. But that's, I don't know how much of a slip that really is. The fact is that all group identities depend on there being another. If there wasn't another, you wouldn't have a group. The group itself would, if it included everybody, would break down into smaller groups that would be the identities. That's not something that white people should feel guilty about, or anybody else, that they are in contrast to another. But people of color is a purely social construct. You know, if white is a social construct, or to the extent white is a social construct, people of color is more of a social construct, because it's really just a euphemism for non-white or not white. So if white doesn't exist, then people of color couldn't exist. And these people who talk about how whiteness is a myth, obviously they believe that people of color really exist. And somebody responds to Shannon Corwin and reiterates that point for me. "Shannon, you are a smart, well-educated American, and girl, you know your history well. The good news is people like Pat are dying out, and the new generations only look at racism as history. I love reading U.S. history, and every time I pick up a book, I learn a little more. I read President Obama isn't our first biracial president, but the sixth one." I don't know what she's talking about there. She doesn't name who they are. "But I learned from leaders like JFK, Dr. King, and first from my parents that I am an American who happens to be of color." So another person who's of color and not a myth. Let me jump to another example. This one is from somebody who's famous, somebody you may have heard of, and you may have heard of this comment before. You may have heard a part of the comment. It's from Susan Sontag, a Jewish woman who was born with the name Rosenblatt, actually. She said that the white race was the cancer of human history. In fact, the longer statement, I think, is telling. It begins, "The truth is that Mozart, Pascal, Boolean algebra, Shakespeare, parliamentary government, Baroque churches, Newton, the emancipation of women, Kant, Marx, and the Balanchine ballets don't redeem what this particular civilization has wrought upon the world. The white race is the cancer of human history. So she's identifying some things about white people with the white race, these positive things, and she's, in typically Jewish fashion, she's expressing her sort of an extra level of hate for the white race and condemnation of the white race by saying, in spite of all these positive things I can list in credit to the white race, all these people that have done these amazing things, I still condemn them as a cancer of human history. It's amazing. But here we have this this contradiction that Susan Sontag doesn't think that the white race is a myth. She credits it with being a cancer and with all of these people, you know, the cancer canceling out all of these, the good works of these other people. So that's just one of many contradictions that you find when you examine this kind of thinking. There was another point I wanted to make about Shannon Corwin's statement. That's it. The nuggets of truth. I mean, and this is true of all of these anti-whites and their expressions of whiteness. They're, even what Shannon had to say, there is some truth in that. And I have talked about it earlier, how the Frenchmen and British and Spaniards and the German and Irish are all nationalities from Europe. They're all subracial categories, but they are racial. They're biological in origin and in nature. So when all they knew was each other and they hadn't broader experience of the world, of course they were at each other's throats and having wars just amongst themselves. And it was when contacting others that the idea of whiteness formed, that Europeans saw that they had more in common with each other than they did with Africans or with Amerindians or with Asians. So what Shannon Corwin had to say had some nuggets of truth buried in it. And likewise with Susan Sontag, she presents a more direct contradiction there in a way that by citing all of this wonderful stuff, all these wonderful people, and then calling them a cancer. I'd like to read the larger context of that, the essay that she put that in, but I doubt that it's redeeming in any way. One important thing, though, is that she was not ostracized in any way. She wasn't fired from her job or blacklisted, to my knowledge. She went on and was rich and famous for the rest of her life and suffered no consequences for saying that nasty stuff about the white race. I'm going to move now to the meat, I think, of this installment, which is I'm going to read a little bit from an essay written by a fella named Tahisi. Let me see if I can get this right. It was a piece, an article in The Atlantic. I'm sorry, my place is a little hard to find here. Yeah. Ta-Nehisi Coates. And this was a recent article, appeared, it's in the September issue, as far as I know, of The Atlantic magazine. And it's titled Fear of a Black President. And this is interesting that it's very similar, it has a similar theme here to the blog post I wrote recently about niggerization, whereby race-conscious blacks, like the fellow I was talking about in that blog post was this guy named Touré, how they freely project their racial fears and animosities onto hopefully deracinated white folk. And that's what this long essay does as well. It starts off by saying, and this is a fellow who has a strong black identity. He's not confused about who he is. He doesn't think that he has to make podcasts asserting what black identity is. He's published by The Atlantic magazine and talks about his blackness and doesn't think that blackness is a myth or anything like that. So It's one of the many advantages that non-whites, people of color, have over whites in the current political environment. The piece begins, "It is often said that Obama's presidency has given black parents the right to tell their kids with a straight face that they can do anything. This is a function not only of Obama's election to the White House, but of the way his presidency broadcasts an easy, almost mystic blackness to the world." A mystic blackness. "The Obama family represents our ideal imagining of ourselves, an ideal we so rarely see on any kind of national stage. What black people are experiencing right now is a kind of privilege previously withheld, seeing our most sacred cultural practices and tropes validated in the world's highest office. Throughout the whole of American history, this kind of cultural power was wielded solely by whites, and with such ubiquity that it was not even commented upon. The expansion of this cultural power beyond the private province of whites has been a tremendous advance for black America." Let me stop right there because I have to make some comments to this. This black fella sees it as good for blacks, what has happened to America. And whites are afraid, really, to say, I mean, we all know in our heart of hearts that things are worse for whites. And if you just, you can read what this fella says as a listing of how great it was for whites. And now he's saying that even though blacks are only getting a small taste of what whites have had all this time up until recently, it's great. It's wonderful. And he loves it. And naturally, he does. And whites loved it when we were on top, too, when it was our country. And that's normal and natural. And we can have that again. We have to make it for ourselves. We have to take it for ourselves. He continues, "Conversely, for those who've long treasured white exclusivity, the existence of a President Barack Obama is discombobulating, even terrifying." This is dishonest. This fella is acting like the white people who, first of all, that they want exclusivity. I think the bulk of the white people he's talking about don't consciously think about exclusivity. They just like to have a race-blind society where they're not constantly being guilt-tripped for being white. People like me want an exclusively white government and state and country like we used to have, at least one that is dedicated to the best interests of white people. That's what I would like to have. And this fella, who's black, wants it for black people, but he's acting as if he wants something that we all equally share in. He doesn't. So, you know, whites need to realize that when they hear this kind of stuff, the trick that's being played. He goes on to cite the Naturalization Act of 1790 in describing how America used to be so white. It was founded by whites for whites. And the Naturalization Act of 1790 is the very first law regarding who could become a U.S. citizen that the U.S. Congress passed. And it began with the statement, "Any alien being a free white person who shall have resided within the limits and under the jurisdiction of the United States for the term of 2 years may be admitted to become a citizen." So it very explicitly says there that a white person, that it's a white country, basically, that only white people can become citizens of this new country. And this was the law of the land up until the early part of the 20th century. As I understand, the definition of white was still being debated, and Asians were being considered in the whether Asians should be excluded or not was being considered. And I won't get into the details of that now, but it was for a long time the country was limited to citizenship was limited to white people. In 1865, of course, at the end of the Civil War, that changed. The 14th Amendment changed it for the blacks who were already in the country. But even this fella, Ta-Nehisi, Ta-Nehisi Coates, recognizes that in the wake of the war, he cites Andrew Johnson, who was the president after Lincoln and after the war was over, scoffed at awarding the Negro the franchise, he says, and he quotes him saying, "The peculiar qualities," this is Andrew Johnson now speaking, "the peculiar qualities which should characterize any people who are fit to decide upon the management of public affairs for a great state have seldom been combined. It is the glory of white men to know that they have had these qualities in sufficient measure to build upon this continent a great political fabric and to preserve its stability for more than 90 years. What's very notable about a black man citing this to white people is, of course, the black man is trying to guilt trip us. He's trying to say, you evil, stupid, crazy white people, this is how you used to talk. Yeah, this is how white people used to talk. This is how white identity, how strong it used to be. We used to have leaders. We used to have presidents of the United States that would talk about being white, about being proud of being white, and about having a government that was dedicated to serving the best interests of white people, with no apology about that. In the wake of the Civil War, in fact, the war that today we're taught, or they try to teach us, was all about ending slavery and declaring everybody equal. It's a load of BS. If there's any myth-making, that's it. Let me quote a little bit more of this article. I've got some time yet. And this part he really must not like. But if anything, this is Johnson still, but if anything can be proved by known facts, if all reasoning upon less capacity, if all reasoning upon evidence is not abandoned, it must be acknowledged that in the progress of nations, Negroes have shown less capacity for government than any other race of people. No independent government of any form has ever been successful in their hands. On the contrary, wherever they have been left to their own devices, they have shown a constant tendency to relapse into barbarism. And we see that today in Zimbabwe and in South Africa, where shiny, thriving civilizations, societies were turned over to black hands and have been reduced to ruins in a lifetime, a single lifetime. So, you know, however much this Coates fella doesn't want to hear it and other blacks don't want to hear it, white people should be not wanting to hear what they have to say about how wonderful it is to have a black man in the White House. It isn't wonderful, and we shouldn't fear expressing ourselves against it, expressing our opinions against it. And this is back to Coates now. He goes on to comment after quoting Johnson there. The notion of blacks as particularly unfit for political equality persisted well into the 20th century. As the nation began considering integrating its military, a young West Virginian wrote to a senator in 1944, and he's quoting this young Virginian, West Virginian, "I am a typical American, a Southerner of 27 years of age. I am loyal to my country and know but reverence to her flag, but I shall never submit to fight beneath that banner with a Negro by my side. I should die 1,000 times and see Old Glory trampled in the dirt." This is, Coates reveals, Ku Klux Klan member Robert Byrd, Senator Robert Byrd, who died in 2010. And the point he's trying to make here is that, you know, the white supremacy lasted into the 20th century. And again, he is upset about that, but that is the fact. And there were white people who asserted their whiteness without any question about who was white and what whiteness was and what it meant, who served in the U.S. Senate up until recently. He then also cites a statement by William F. Buckley, Jr., who addressed the, quote, moral disgrace of segregation by endorsing disenfranchisement strictly based on skin color. And this is William Buckley now talking. The central question that emerges, and it is not a parliamentary question or a question that is answered by merely consulting a catalog of the rights of American citizens born equal, is whether the white community in the South is entitled to take such measures as are necessary to prevail politically and culturally in areas in which it does not predominate numerically. The sobering answer is yes, the white community is so entitled, because for the time being, it is the advanced race. So William F. Buckley, as Coates cites here, is the founder of National Review, and he went on to assert, quote, the great majority of the Negroes of the South who do not vote, do not care to vote, and would not know what to vote for if they could. Well, that was wrong. We know that given the choice of a black man or woman to vote for, they'll vote 100-0. In favor of the black. They vote as a block for the black, and they vote for black interests, as whites used to do so as well. And that's the point, I think, of tonight's installment, is and why I titled it Suppression and Repression. We see evidence of both in today's environment. We see this guilt-tripping, this constant negativity, that this painting of white as something stupid, crazy, and evil. And at the same time, we also see that white people really don't want to talk about it. They want to ignore the past and the history, and to the point where we're being lectured about our own past and about what whiteness means by people who are anti-white. It's bizarre. It's completely unnatural. It would be difficult for me to imagine how we got here if I hadn't already gone through a series of podcasts explaining how I think we got here and laying out the various elements of it. And so it is fairly clear to me how we got here. I haven't given a historic layout of a timeline of how we got here, but I have laid out the ideological framework and the steps and the psychological tricks that have been used. But the takeaway tonight is this combination of suppression and repression. And the evidence here is in even what the anti-whites have to say about it, that there is, they admit, something to whiteness. The first one claimed it's a myth, but obviously, they don't all agree that it's a myth, and some of them take it seriously and treat it like it's real. And we should treat it like it's real, too. It is real. It's as real as people of color. It's as real as blackness. It's as real as being a Jew. So I'll talk more about whiteness as a from a purely positive point of view, I think, as we go a little further along here. I'm tired of this negativity myself. I'm tired of this negative anti-white attitude all around us, and I want to start talking about some of the more positive ways of seeing whiteness. So I hope you'll join me for some of that, and I hope you're looking forward to it as much as I am. I'll see you next time.